Right now, save 50 to 70% off absolutely everything at Gap Factory. Even better, get 40% off clearance styles, plus t-shirts from $4.99 and shorts from $9.99. And just in time for summer, save 50 to 70% off the entire store at Banana Republic Factory. Plus, 50% off clearance and doorbuster dresses and polos starting at $19.99. Only at Banana Republic Factory stores. Search our store locator for your nearest Gap Factory and Banana Republic Factory store, or shop us online.
You've reached the High Fashion Hotline.
Help! My family's hosting an epic Memorial Day barbecue, and we need to look as legendary as our spread to kick off the summer right.
Get to Old Navy.
Old Navy?
Yep, right now, splash into summer with an incredible 50% off all tees, all tanks, all shorts, all dresses, and all swimwear at Old Navy and OldNavy.com.
Wow, 50% off all those styles? Now that's epic.
So is this. Tees start at just $6, but hurry, it ends Monday.
50% off and tees from $6? Old Navy, here we come.
High Fashion, Old Navy. Valid 525 to 528. Excludes clearance, active, licensed flag products, and men's packaged.
Everybody, you're listening live to the United Public Radio Network. Excuse me for that. Getting a little sidetracked. We're in conversations back here in beautiful Studio Control. We are watching for any signs of Tropical Storm Alberto, which means that we're going to be able to date this show to you. This is the last weekend, or the Memorial Day weekend in 2018 here on the southern coast in Mississippi. So far, we haven't seen any indications of even any precipitation at this point. They had this really weird name for the storm called Invest 90L, or, you know, something like what you might have your Wi-Fi router named by AT&T if by default, was what came up on the Weather Channel. Is what is that? And sometime between yesterday and this morning, the governor of the state of Florida, I think his name is Rick Scott, declared it an emergency situation there in the state of Florida. It turned magically red on the map on the Weather Channel. Thank you, Weather Channel graphics people, thereby scaring a bunch of people if they're sitting around in restaurants across the country that happen to be tuned into the Weather Channel so far. Now, what they've been really concerned with is the amount of people taking an early summer vacation and coming here to the Gulf Coast in the United States, anywhere from Of course, all the way over in Brownsville, Corpus Christi, Texas, all the way across to the western side of the Florida, you know, I guess probably even a little past Destin there. Everybody that has booked in is already traveling down here to the Gulf Coast to go on their vacation for Memorial Day. And, of course, they were forecasting doom and gloom and wave surge warnings, flash flood warnings. For example, the area in southern Mississippi that I and the radio station are in is approximately between 0 to 30 miles inland of the Gulf of Mexico at the moment, is under a flash flood advisory all the way from now, which is approximately 5 p.m. Eastern time, until Tuesday. At some given point, the weather advisory here will lift for the potential for flash flooding because we are in the watershed of several rivers on the eastern side of the Mississippi River. And what happens about 3 hours north of me rain-wise is the headwaters of a big river, and it goes all the way down. And so if I wanted to drive for like 3 hours from where I'm sitting, I could then, you know, dump some toxic chemical in there, and eventually it would show up in front of the radio station in the bayou. Joe would be looking out the window saying, "What in the hell is Greg up there pouring some radioactive nonsense into the watershed, and now it's leaking out here and glowing?" But the key thing with this is, don't do it, folks. Don't pour your oil down the storm drain and all that, because you would be polluting the water table and the watershed no matter where you're at. It's not worth it. Properly recycle these materials. Don't be dumping used or mixed up diesel fuel or, you know, old weed eater gas that has been mixed with oil and put in your lawn equipment and stuff. You pull it out of the garage because you finally can either get to the weed eater or actually need to use the weed eater. Don't just dump the stuff in the storm drain, because environmental responsibility begins with you. That being said, within the last couple of hours, the marijuana advocate known as the New Jersey Weed Man has been acquitted in a retrial. This coming from the Associated Press in Trenton, New Jersey. A New Jersey marijuana advocate dubbed the New Jersey Weed Man kind of like a superhero, right, has been acquitted of witness tampering in his retrial. NJ, which is the abbreviation for New Jersey, but NJ.com, reports that Ed Forshaw raised his arms in victory after the verdict Thursday in Mercer County Superior Court. His supporters cheered, and he smilingly invited the prosecutor to his victory party, which we don't know whether or not the victory party is actually like a weed man party. The charges stem from a raid narcotics officers executed at his Trenton eatery. Mr. Forshaw streamed his March 2017 arrest live on Facebook and denied the charges. Prosecutors argued that he was putting an informant at risk by spreading his name on social media. Mr. Forshaw said he was just exercising his First Amendment rights of free speech. A jury in November of 2017 acquitted him of one count of witness tampering and couldn't reach a verdict on the second. He acted as his own attorney in both cases. If you want some more information on that, feel free to go to nj.com. That's newjersey.com. Just a little, you know, little bitty, you know, strange news there. You know, talking about people being acquitted and all that craziness. Well, you know, Donald Trump has been kind of in activist mode when it comes to U.S. Citizens being held prisoner abroad. There was the release of the people who were being held by North Korea in the last couple of weeks. In case you missed that, President Trump sent in his letter to Kim Jong-un explaining the Trump administration's withdrawal from the negotiations for a summit type of meeting. And that's what we could say is summit type of meeting. It was a meeting that was supposed to be arranged between President Trump and Kim Jong-un of Korea to meet in Singapore. It has been ping pong back and forth. But one of the things that did happen was the North Korean government released three Americans, sent them home. And the president thanked Mr. Kim in his letter while at the same time explaining the administration's position on not conducting the summit at this time. And then, of course, there's the ping pong part. Of course, the administration officials and the president saying it might happen. There might be a meeting between Kim and President Trump in Singapore after all. So we kind of have to say, well, we don't really know whether or not it's actually going to be canceled, because the president is playing basically the same fiddle that the North Koreans are playing at the same time. It just depends on whose tune do you want to dance to. President Trump says U.S. prisoner Josh Holt has been released in Venezuela. President Donald Trump announced this morning that American prisoner Josh Holt has been released from prison in Venezuela. President Trump, of course, using Twitter for a lot of things. The president loves him Twitter. Good news about the release of the American hostage from Venezuela. Should be landing in D.C. this evening and be in the White House with his family at about 7 p.m. So that is about 2 hours from now, Eastern time. The great people of Utah will be very happy. Mr. Holt, age 26, a Utah native, is a Mormon missionary who traveled to Venezuela in June 2016 to marry Venezuelan Tamara Colano, a fellow Mormon. According to news reports, he was arrested shortly afterward and accused by the Venezuelan government of stockpiling weapons and attempting to destabilize the government, according to the Washington Post. Mr. Holt was held for nearly 2 years without standing trial. Mr. Holt's release comes more than a week after he posted videos to Facebook during a prison riot, pleading for help from Americans and the United States government. In one video, he said, "I've been begging my government for 2 years. They say they're doing things, but I'm still here." Mr. Holt and his wife were freed overnight and released to the United States Embassy in Caracas, Venezuela, according to Foro Penal, a human rights organization of lawyers and others who assist political prisoners in Venezuela. The couple were scheduled to head to the airport in Caracas around midday on Saturday, according to a Farrell Pinnell spokesman. There has not been any official announcement or comment from Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's government at this time. At 5:08 Eastern time, if I get some more information on that while we're live, of course, I will try to update myself. President Trump tweeted a second time today, saying, looking forward to seeing Joshua Holt this evening in the White House. The great people of Utah are celebrating. Now, aides were asked to prepare for President Trump to deliver a statement on Mr. Holt's release sometime Saturday night from the White House, according to a White House official. The details were still being worked out. We just wonder why these officials always want to remain nameless. We'll get to that, I guess, in a minute. We're grateful to all those who participated in this miracle, Holt's family said in a statement. Now, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah announced that his office helped secure Mr. Holt's release, stating, I'm pleased to announce that after 2 years of hard work, we've secured the release of Josh and Tammy Holt, who are now on their way home to the United States from Venezuela, Senator Hatch said in a tweet. Over the last 2 years, I've worked with two presidential administrations, countless diplomatic contacts, ambassadors from all over the world, a network of contacts in Venezuela, and President Maduro himself. And I could not be more honored to be able to reunite Josh with his sweet, long-suffering family in Riverton, Utah, according to Senator Hatch. I want to thank Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker for his pivotal efforts and that of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for their help in this effort. I want to particularly thank Caleb McCary, whose expertise and effort in Venezuela on my behalf has been instrumental in bringing Josh home. Corker is traveling back to the United States with Joshua Holt and his wife after he went to Venezuela to win their release. He says, I am pleased to join Senator Hatch and President Trump in announcing the release of Josh and Tammy Holt, Bob Corker said in a statement. Senator Hatch has worked tirelessly on the Holt's family behalf, and I was honored to play a small role in bringing Josh and his wife home to the United States. I would also like to thank Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his team at the State Department for all that they have done. Other members of Congress expressed their elation over Mr. Holt's release. U.S. Representative Mia Love, a Utah Republican, tweeted, after nearly 2 years, Josh Holt is finally coming home. Thanks to Donald Trump and others who I've had the pleasure to work with to secure Josh's freedom, followed by hashtag justice for Josh. Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, a member of the Foreign Relations Committee, praised Senator Hatch for working tirelessly to bring this innocent young man and his bride home. Josh and Tammy Holt had nothing to do with internal politics. Politics in Venezuela, Senator Rubio said on Twitter. So there you go, keeping up with that. So now it has been the fourth, what we would call a United States prisoner abroad, being brought home by the Trump administration in the last 30 days. I think that's probably been more effective than the last several months of the Obama administration's efforts to secure release of U.S. persons being held abroad on various charges and whatnot. And one thing to be fair, which we always try to do here on Voice of the People Radio, is to be fair, we also have to say that it's not because of a necessarily faulted effort by the Obama administration. It's just when foreign governments, other than, you know, the United States, when foreign governments are negotiating with the United States State Department and they know that the outgoing president is not up for re-election, so they're not trying to win the release of the person, and they are working on behalf of the family, and it is not a, you know, a life or death situation for one of these political prisoner releases. What happens is they play a little bit of politics themselves and put the prisoner exchange kind of on the back burner, and they play a little bit of political football. Of course, their representatives come in and saying, we want some form of concession from the United States in relation to this prisoner. Is sort of a, you give us this and we'll give up the prisoner kind of thing. It's a state to state or country to country version kind of let's make a deal, is we have your prisoner, and this is what we want. And sometimes they don't want to deal with administrations, like when President Obama was about ready to leave office. President Obama ends up with nobody coming back to the United States because the foreign government knows President Obama in 3 or 4 months was no longer going to be president of the United States, and they might have had a better bargaining position with incoming administration, no matter whether it was negotiating with a potential Hillary Clinton administration or negotiating with a potential Donald Trump administration. Okay, the foreign governments, they will hold on to anything that they can, that they consider an asset or something that they'd be able to trade off. And in this case, they were holding people of interest for whatever reasons. They can say what they want to in their news and on their television and on their radio reports about why the people are being held. A lot of times in cases like North Korea, it is, of course, played off to the Korean people from only one side. And so they are told that an American was in North Korea attempting to commit some act of espionage. And then it goes on to the media. Well, in the case of young Otto Warmbier, who was returned to the United States and who was medically in a comatose state and then passed away soon after having been returned to the United States, that's kind of extenuated and extreme on the circumstantial level. But he was not returned until it became a political advantage for North Korea. Just like the three prisoners who were returned earlier in the last month from North Korea, that was done to gain some form of political advantage between North Korea and the Trump administration. If this was 2 years from now and the president was up for re-election, they may or may not have made the move to free those people. In the case of the president of Venezuela, you can bet that at this point in time there is something that has been traded, even though we may never find out what was given to Venezuela and President Nicolas Maduro's government in exchange for the release of this young man, Mr. Josh Holt, and his wife, who are headed to the White House this evening in Washington, D.C. on a flight. And hopefully they will be able to adjust after his being basically in captivity in Venezuela for the last couple of years. And hopefully they will have a long and fruitful life here in the United States. They may choose to go out as sometimes people in the Mormon church do, and still do more missionary work in the field. So time will tell, but rest assured there's always some form of give and take. So we don't know exactly what the Trump administration is giving up to the Maduro government in Venezuela, but we shall see. And usually things that are concessionary with the government in Venezuela is tied to the OPEC standing. And Venezuela is the only American country which is part of the OPEC cartel, or the oil producing cartel of states. And most of Venezuela's oil exports are done to the United States directly across the Gulf of Mexico. We have this tropical storm Alberto developing at the moment, so we felt we should see exactly how that plays out. And good luck to the Trump administration with Mr. Holt. And that is breaking in the last several hours. Sometimes it takes years for these, you know, for these type of things to take place. It's, you know, and sometimes, you know, we can become a little cynical, and you can say, yeah, well, look at the Iran-Contra situation and the hostages that were taken in Lebanon, and then they were returned to the United States only after Jimmy Carter lost the election, and President-elect Reagan had made such and such a deal, eventually America finding out almost 8 years later, and it was called the Iran-Contra affair, that the president-elect and powers to be within the working group of his election campaign had cut a side deal with Iran to get the hostages released. If Ronald Reagan was elected president of the United States, the hostages came home. You can play a little bit of an alternative history here and ask, you know, the question, what would happen if Ronald Reagan, you know, tried to make some kind of deal and then failed to win election in 1980, what would have happened to the hostages? But we may never know. So we will just not speculate on that. And as history tells us, 30 years ago, it finally came out in the wash about what the president-elect's team was doing behind the scenes to get those hostages released. That's kind of, you know, and not to draw exacting parallels, but it's kind of like what's been going on with the craziness with this Trump investigation and Mueller and the FBI and what happens now. We have spoken on Voice of the People Radio many times, and you may have thought, you know, we were making a tongue-in-cheek joke and referencing the investigators who are investigating the investigation into whether or not the Trump campaign had any form of collusion with the Russian government when it came to the 2016 presidential election. Well, it turns out, you know, that there is, you know, the Justice Department and FBI, you know, have to brief the Congress on the fact that there was a informant in the Trump campaign. I mean, that's, and so Trump last week, President Trump calls for an investigation of the investigators who are already, you know, investigating the election for possible Russian tampering. Everybody speculates as to whether or not the president was going to fire Bob Mueller, former director of the FBI, who was put in charge of this investigation. And it has come, I think, come down to, just in my opinion, that the president is playing the long game. And by firing Mr. Mueller, it then feeds political speculation and news media fervor. And everyone's saying, well, if President Trump fires the former FBI director that's investigating the campaign, then that means that on the face of it, it's an admission of guilt by the president that he did something crooked with the Russians. And that's not necessarily the case, and we're not defending the Trump campaign. It's just you can't make an assumption based on an action that hasn't happened yet. President Trump has not fired the former FBI director, excuse me, who was leading that investigation. You know, and after a series of evolving pronouncements and significant posturing, lawmakers from both parties attended a pair of briefings on Thursday of last week. This Thursday, today being Saturday, and you're listening to Voice of the People Radio on United Public Radio Network. But on Thursday, a pair of briefings about the FBI's use of an informant during its investigation into connections between Russian actors, not actors like in stage actors or movie actors, but Russian intelligence personnel and members of the Donald Trump for President campaign in 2015, 2016, and of course, President winning the election in November of 2016. So senior intelligence and law enforcement officials, including FBI Director Christopher Wray, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and Director of National Intelligence
Dan Coats attended these briefings. Two White House officials, Chief of Staff John Kelly and lawyer Emmett Flood, attended a portion of the meetings, though the White House later said in a statement that Kelly and Flood only made brief remarks before the meetings started to relay the president's desire for as much openness as possible under the law. Neither John Kelly nor lawyer Emmett Flood was present for the meetings themselves, according to the White House. Okay? They also conveyed the president's understanding of the need to protect human intelligence services and the importance of communication between the branches of government. The top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat of California, attended the briefings and called Mr. Flood, the attorney's presence, completely inappropriate, a sentiment he did not hide from Mr. Flood during the briefings. Emmett Flood's presence and statement at the outset of both meetings today was completely inappropriate, Mr. Schiff said in a statement. Although he did not participate in the meetings which followed as the White House's attorney handling the special counsel investigation, his involvement in any capacity was entirely improper, and I made this clear to him. Representative Schiff also said that his presence only underscores what Rudy Giuliani said. The president's legal team expects to use information gleaned improperly from the Justice Department or the president's allies in Congress to their legal advantage. Now, Mr. Warner echoed the statement, tweeting that the president's chief of staff and his attorney in an ongoing criminal investigation into the president's campaign have no business showing up to a classified intelligence briefing. Now, the plans for the briefings, even those that were announced publicly, changed repeatedly in the hours leading up to them. The apparent result of behind-the-scenes partisan tug-of-war about who should be briefed, where they should be briefed, and who should be there. In what appeared to be an extraordinary concession to the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes, Republican of California, the briefings were ultimately conducted in two rounds. One at noon on Thursday took place at the Department of Justice and was attended by Chairman Devin Nunes, Representative Trey Gowdy, Republican of South Carolina, Representative Schiff from California, and House Speaker Paul Ryan from Wisconsin. A second briefing, which took place 2 hours later in a secure space on Capitol Hill, included the gang of eight, minus Speaker Paul Ryan, who cited a scheduling conflict. In a statement, Representative and Speaker Paul Ryan later thanked the Justice Department for arranging the briefing, but declined to elaborate, saying, "I cannot and will not comment on a classified session." Well, it's kind of wonder why the media even asks. Democrats, for their part, emerged from the briefings unmoved, speaking on behalf of the Democratic faction of the Gang of Eight. Representative Schiff said, "Today's Gang of Eight briefing was conducted to ensure protection of sources and methods. Nothing we heard today has changed our view that there is no evidence to support any allegation that the FBI or any intelligence agency placed a spy in the Trump campaign or otherwise failed to follow appropriate procedures and protocols." And of course, this is quoting Representative. Now, in recent days, President Trump has issued a number of tweets accusing the FBI of planting and paying a spy in his campaign, which he on Wednesday termed Spygate and later decried as illegal and one of the political scandals in U.S. history. It is unclear whether the Republicans who attended were satisfied with the briefing's outcome. Representative Devin Nunes has subpoenaed documents, which he and other Republican allies have argued are required for proper oversight of the department's investigation, and threatened to hold Christopher Wray and Rosenstein in contempt if they are not provided those documents. Before the noon briefing, Representative Trey Gowdy had told CBS News without elaborating, "There are certain things you can only learn from documents and certain things you can learn from briefings." Democrats have expressed concerns that Republicans' demands are animated by a desire to undermine the work of Special Counsel Robert Mueller, or else to directly inform the president's legal strategy. There was at least one indication that the latter was a consideration. In an interview with Politico, Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani said on Thursday, "We want to see how the briefing went and how much we learned from it. If we learned a good deal from it, it will shorten that whole process considerably," said Rudy Giuliani. Now, Democrats involved in the briefing seemed perturbed at a minimum by the possibility that some information could get back to the president. As he left what has been called the Gang of Eight briefing, Senate Intelligence Committee Vice Chairman Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, called the smaller noon briefing at the Department of Justice a rogue meeting, though he said the White House officials left before the meeting was substantively underway. He added, "Never seen a Gang of Eight meeting that included any presence from the White House. Unusual times," Mr. Warner said. So there you go. Take away from that what you will. That is immediate take on what is going on. You know, and of course, in the media, there's this comparison thing. Richard Painter says there's more evidence against Donald Trump than there was against Richard Nixon. You can find things called the plot against Donald Trump. I mean, it goes on. Trump says that White House official who briefed reporters in person doesn't exist. James Comey, what is behind the Trump FBI spy theory? I mean, it just goes on and on. Basically, what, you know, in my opinion, what's been going on with some of this coverage of this situation with this investigation has been that the media is basically taking this and saying a source, because they don't have to give up their source. The media doesn't have to give up their source. So there's possibility, and you have to always keep that in mind. There is a possibility that a news organization, be it ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox News, any of the major media outlets, and most of them have been found to have done this in the last few years. There's always the possibility somebody has made up a statement, they have drawn a conclusion, and they have named sources which remain unnamed in a particular story on the media that there is no source for. And they are taking advantage of the good faith of the American public and saying unnamed sources, or sources which may be revealed at a later time, or sources who chose not to be named, or confidential sources. Sometimes in some of these articles and suppositions and things that are going on with all of this, undoubtedly, at least twice that I personally can recall, but undoubtedly, some of the so-called coverage of these events have been attributed to personnel within the government that are not sources, or the source that is supposedly used for the article does not exist. And some of these have been opinion pieces. Some of these have been cobbled together speculations by certain reporters. And the president coming out and saying, a White House official who briefed reporters in person doesn't exist. It doesn't surprise me at all that the president would come out and say something like that. Because in a lot of cases, the news media has basically been feeding the American public something, and nine times out of ten, there is no named source. It's always an anonymous source, a source within the administration, you know, something crazy, okay? And it's gotten used to the point that what happens is it's being taken advantage of. All right, it's just, you know, not happening like it used to. It used to be that the news media, the Fifth Estate, would have to be objective, would not take sides, and would bring to you who, what, when, where, why, and how. Now all they have to do is say, sources said, and fill in the rest of their story. They are expected to not reveal their sources because the source deserves to be protected. Well, what's being challenged here is that there is no source. President Trump today claimed at 2:02 Eastern Daylight Time, or so this was published, claimed that the New York Times quoted a senior White House official who doesn't exist, and the president, using Twitter as his media, you know, outlet of choice, he said, "Use real people, not phony sources," on Twitter, President Trump. But reporters listened to that official in person and on the phone on Thursday during a White House-sanctioned background briefing. Now, according to CBS News, who we're going to for this particular bit of information, CBS News is not publishing the name of the White House official, as the ground rules for the background briefing called for keeping the official anonymous. The official was asked to put the name on the record, but that request was denied. And we're using the mainstream media because they're the ones reporting on each other and saying that the president is, of course, saying use real people, not phony sources. In his tweet today on Saturday, President Trump quoted a portion of a New York Times article that referred to what the official from the White House had said. What the president quoted was not a direct quote of the official, but rather the New York Times paraphrasing, using different words, of the official's comments on an anticipated but then canceled June 12th summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The newspaper, the New York Times, reported that a senior White House official told reporters that even if the meeting were reinstated, holding it on June 12th would be impossible given the lack of time and the amount of planning that is needed. While the official didn't use the word impossible, the official said, when asked if a June 12th summit would still be possible, that there's really not a lot of time to make that happen, and June 12th is in 10 minutes. There's really not a lot of time, the official told reporters Thursday. We've lost quite a bit of time that we would need in order to, there's been an enormous amount of preparation that's gone on over the past few months at the White House, at the State Department, and with other agencies and so forth, but there's a certain amount of actual dialogue that needs to take place at the working level with your counterparts to ensure that the agenda is clear in the minds of those two leaders when they sit down to actually meet and talk and negotiate and hopefully make a deal. June 12th is in 10 minutes, and the president has said that someday he looks forward to meeting with him. Now, the president has offered different messages on North Korea since canceling the summit, most recently indicating that it might still happen on June 12th. We are having very productive talks with North Korea about reinstating the summit, which, if it does happen, will likely remain in Singapore on the same date, June 12th, and if necessary, will extend beyond that date, the president tweeted last night. Again, the president taking to Twitter. And then all of this, you know, argument about somebody paraphrasing what a source tells news reporters on a conference on Thursday. And the person who's an official going on the record with all this. And then the president of the United States says they don't exist. This isn't the first time the president has accused the media of making up sources. In a radio interview last month, for example, the president complained about why he would be skipping the White House correspondents' dinner. Said, I sort of feel that the press is so bad. It's so fake. It's so made up. I mean, sources say, and then they have no sources. They're like novelists. I call them novelists. That's a quote of the president of the United States, Donald Trump, saying that the press is that bad. Again, coming out and saying that sources that are being quoted by the media from Thursday. What happened was the media paraphrased something that was said by the official, and then the president read the paraphrased, which is taking what someone said and putting it in different words, thereby not directly quoting what they said, which might give away who it was that said it or in what context it was said. Given somebody's knowledge of how many people were engaged in other things, then sometimes somebody can put a pin in it and figure out who the person was supposed to be that the media had gotten the information from. Well, in this case, the president basically saying that the news people, they made up the source, which is his prerogative. I mean, he can go on Twitter and make up words if he wants to. President of the United States has a Twitter account. Now, here's something to give some thought to. A federal judge has ruled that the president, Donald Trump, of the United States, President Donald Trump, has a Twitter account. If you're not entirely familiar with Twitter, usually people use handles for Twitter. The Twitter account for the Voice of the People radio, for example, is @ on your keyboard. It's @ VOTPR for Voice of the People Radio. It's an abbreviation. It's kind of like FBI is for Federal Bureau of Investigation. Well, @VOTPR, you can tweet directly to Voice of the People Radio. You can tweet the president @RealDonaldTrump is the president's Twitter handle, R-E-A-L, Donald Trump, because he has had put on his Twitter account the word real to denote that it actually was Donald Trump using Twitter before running for president of the United States. There are a lot of celebrities who are impersonated or made fun of on the social media platforms like Twitter. So the president's handle is @RealDonaldTrump if you want to catch up with that. And that seems to be, other than having Sarah Huckabee Sanders doing the press secretary bit there at the White House in the briefing room, it seems to be the president's favorite medium for being able to give the American people some information. Now, the federal judge said the president cannot block people from @RealDonaldTrump on his Twitter account. So if you are subscribed to Donald Trump's tweets and you want to say something back to the president, the judge for now has said the president @RealDonaldTrump on Twitter is not allowed to block you, which means that you can then send a message with the name of the president from Twitter @RealDonaldTrump. And if he is set up to use Twitter, where every time his name is mentioned on the Twitter for his personal account, then he cannot block you if you say something controversial or derogatory or just plain nasty or just something he doesn't want to hear. For now, that has held up within the last few days. And, you know, that's a thing. That's a thing that should probably be taken up for the polls. You should kind of pay attention to that. Maybe there'll be a poll put up on News on the Flip Side here on the United Public Radio Network as well, asking people what their opinion is about whether or not people beyond the President of the United States is not allowed to block you on Twitter. Is there anyone else who should not be able to block people on Twitter? Should people running for public office as a candidate not be able to block you on Twitter? Should people who are already holding public office, politicians, your representative in state government, your state representative, your state senator, your congressman, your member of the Senate representing your state, of which you have two, should those people also not be able to block you, John Q. Public, on Twitter? The president, according to this federal ruling by this judge, for now, is not able to block your comments to or about the president on Twitter, so that it eventually shows up somewhere where, you know, he doesn't have to read it, but it's available for him to read. And everyone knows that has been paying attention to Twitter in particular, that it has also been subject to an argument where the president's Twitter announcements and things that he says on his profile on Twitter.com are being archived for the future and what is going to eventually become the Donald J. Trump presidential library and records about his presidency. And so Twitter has also not been allowed to permanently erase anything if the president removes it from his Twitter account. It is still archived and eventually end up in an archive as part of the president's interaction with the media and the American people. The president basically creating his own media, his own feed, his own stream, his own remarks, and of course his use of Twitter to get across to the American people the thoughts and ideas that he has in you know, in the limited number of characters that are available to him on the platform. And it is being archived so that people in the future can see what the president had posted on Twitter, and then do some kind of statistical analysis to see what kind of reactions he got from the American people and whether or not any of that actually affected public policy. It's going to be a matter of interest for future historians. It's a matter of interest for, of course, those of us in the media and you in the listening public for now. And it's very intriguing that a federal judge made a ruling saying the president is not allowed to block people. Well, who else should not be able to block people? You know, or should it stay the way it was before there was a federal judge ruling on it? And not only the president, but you know, other politicians should be able to block or pick whoever they choose not to have show up on their Twitter feed, you know, on their screen, on their phone, on their tablet, on their computer screen, wherever their Twitter feed is showing up. Because people can actually go and they can mute the president's Twitter account. They could follow the president on Twitter and then mute the president's account so that they actually don't see what the president writes on Twitter, so it would not show up on their page of stuff other people tweeted anyhow. It was just interesting that the federal judge made this ruling saying the president is not allowed to block anybody, since the president is supposedly using Twitter.com and at Real Donald Trump is his Twitter handle to communicate information with the American people, which is then being permanently archived. And the president blocking people on Twitter, meaning they would not be able to receive or send him any messages, and they would not have the president's messages show up. And I guess the judge's interpretation is that since he's the president, he cannot deprive a person of being able to read what he said. So we'll keep you apprised if that situation changes and how that ruling and all of that pairs off. And I really think that the president probably doesn't really care too much about whether or not people are able to block him personally. But he probably personally cares on some level that Twitter has taken away his ability to block people on his end. and he probably has some kind of feeling about the, you know, powers that be at Twitter being subject to a federal judge saying you must make it so that the president cannot block people. You know, he, I think, would say that his personal preferences, his ability to completely control his Twitter account is being held up by a federal judge, and the control is being taken out of his hands as president of the United States. I don't know if he would go as far as to assign that to the federal judge making any political move, or if it's just the federal judge's personal interpretation of the law, which is what they're supposed to do. That's their job description. You know, the federal judgeship, just like a civil court in your town, your city, the federal judgeship, their job is to interpret the law. Now, their job is not to create law by making rulings on things and then saying it must be done this way. They're not the king. They can't make edicts and say all must follow and obey and do forthwith. But the president probably feels that his personal, you know, his personal franchise on Twitter, for what it's worth, is being tampered with at the time by this federal judge. Whether now, what would be really interesting to find out, I guess, would be whether the president actually wants to block people. So that may be something you want to send to @realDonaldTrump on Twitter.com. Send him the message and ask him, Mr. President, do you really block or want to block other people on Twitter? ? I mean, that's, and you will probably get some kind of response. You know, so I mean, the thing is to not make the assumption as to what the person is thinking. And unfortunately, when federal judges make rulings on things involving this president in particular, it has been in the news media, it has been controversial, and it has been ongoing since day one of this president's administration, following his very first executive order with what has famously been called the Trump travel ban. And it involved, you know, ruling upon ruling upon ruling from federal judges in federal districts, and it has been an ongoing saga. President making revisions, changing things, and making new presidential executive orders because of the involvement and circuitousness of these federal judgeships, who then say the president is not allowed to do that, or someone files a lawsuit in the state of Hawaii saying this is unfair to people traveling in and out of our state for whatever reason, according to what the president did with his executive order, and they make a challenge. Well, it's part of the American system, is being able to make a challenge and say, I agree with this, I do not agree with this, and also, presidential executive orders, they are not laws, and they are not meant for the president to be going around the United States Congress, including the Senate, and making a law, and they should not be interpreted by the United States Congress and Senate as if the presidential executive order is, in fact, on the face of things, a law in and of itself. It is not. It is a presidential executive order from the executive level of the federal government to applicable places and operations within the federal government, including the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the incoming and outgoing airplane traffic and security in the United States and beyond on behalf of the United States government. That's what his executive order was. The president's executive orders are not laws. The president cannot put a law on the table for the House and the Senate to look over. The president can have a representative of Congress, a representative or a senator, introduce a piece of legislation which the president may have worked with the representative in the House or the senator in the Senate on points with the legislation, but that's why they're called legislators. It means lawmaker. The House, representatives of the House and the representative of the Senate make the laws. The president signs them, yes or no, depending on if they get a majority of vote in the House and Senate to go to the president's desk. The president cannot just take out a piece of paper and write out, I want this to happen, make this happen. This is a presidential executive order number 123 and sign it, Donald Trump, and it becomes the law of the land. It's not how it works. Unfortunately, the presidential executive orders have gotten so much attention in the past few administrations after the September 11th attacks, and then President Obama with several of the executive orders that he put forward, doing things like the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals or the DACA program, which directed the Department of Homeland Security and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement or the ICE office to allow for a paperwork procedural process by which individuals who would otherwise be illegally in the United States, had they been brought over the border knowing that they were in violation of any sort of law, they were children when they were brought illegally into the United States by others. Presidential order and DACA is not a law. The president has said in his State of the Union address at the beginning of the year, much to the chagrin of the House and the Senate and people in both parties therein, there are a couple of independents, and then there are the Democrats and the Republicans in the U.S. Congress and the Senate. And the president said he wanted to have comprehensive immigration reform and a plan for the people who are in the United States illegally to have a path to citizenship put on his desk by the U.S. Congress. Whether it takes the path of citizenship to the extreme in that the person being able to apply for citizenship to the United States could possibly take as long as 6 to 8 years for the person to become a legal citizen, but he wants to see that bill on his desk. Since then, people in the media have lambasted the president and the executive branch and saying nothing is moving forward on it. It's Congress's job to move forward on this, not the president's. The president has said, I want a law on my desk that solves this problem, that solves the problem that was addressed by President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals presidential executive order, and I'm letting the mandates that are underneath the presidential executive order have their time and have it expire so that the Congress has to act so that there is a law and the government has to go back to simply doing one thing, which is enforcing the laws that we already have. If the United States government focuses on enforcing laws we already have, then things run a lot better. That's why we have the laws. People have said in the House and Senate, I think this will work because this, and other people say, well, I don't think it's going to work because of that. And eventually a majority says, well, we agree with the first guy. We think that's going to work. So that it gets through the committees, it goes to the president's desk, the president signs it into law, and then you have to deal with, you know, the consequences and things that have happened, and people go back and they say, well, I think the law needs to be changed because this type of thing is happening. They say, what? Oh, well, people are bringing children over the borders of the United States from Canada, from Mexico, from, you know, the Atlantic, the Pacific, the Caribbean, the land borders, the sea borders, and something needs to be done because these children are being brought into the United States and they have no idea that they're not naturally born American citizens. And the Congress said, eh. And so President Obama had to write the DACA presidential executive order so that there was a mechanism in place to protect what is seen to be the privilege of these children brought into the United States, and because of the fact that culturally they have been raised from childhood to believe and understand that they were Americans, only to find out that, in fact, what has happened is due to circumstances beyond their control, they have been informed by a family member or someone in the government that they were brought into the United States as a child without their parents legally having immigrated into the United States, and therefore they have just as illegal a status as their relative or their parent who is responsible for bringing them into the United States. It's really that simple. And the president has said in his State of the Union address, he wants to see a path to citizenship for the people who are illegally in the United States that Democrats in Congress do not want to even admit that the president called for a comprehensive position on immigration for the benefit of those people in the United States so that they can have a path to citizenship other than DACA available to them and available to their parents and their grandparents and their other relatives that may be in the United States illegally. It's really that simple. But when they don't want something because they don't get this political game, of course, it gets stymied. It gets stuck in the mud. It gets to go nowhere. And if we had a Democratic president who was pushing for an immigration reform and not necessarily a 100% amnesty for those in the country illegally, which is what some people think the DACA is, it's not an amnesty program. It is there because if you were to deport the children back to the country that their parents brought them from, they are going to be culturally dissimilar. They're not going to have any idea how things work. And in a lot of cases, they're not even going to know the language. They're not going to know the customs. They're not going to know the culture. And they're going to have been uprooted from living in the United States as they had their whole life. And President Trump stood there in front of the American people during his State of the Union address and said he wants to see, you know, something on his desk so that these people have a path to citizenship. You know, then they can become law-abiding, legal United States citizens who pay taxes just like everybody else. Don't have to worry about immigration and custom enforcement agents and the local police kicking the door in and taking them away. It's one of the other things, I guess. What we'll have to do is pick up on some of this on Tuesday, as it has now reached the top of the 6 o'clock hour Eastern Standard Time. This has been your host, Greg Miller, with Voice of the People Radio. I want to give you this a reminder. You can email us for the show at voiceofthepeopleradio@gmail.com and voiceofthepeopleradio@hotmail.com in order to get your questions answered, resolved issues, if you have any suggestions for guests, if you want to tell me how much rope I need to hang myself. But we will be back on Tuesday, and we come to you from 10 to 11 Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday evenings with 1 hour edition of Voice of the People Radio. Do stay tuned to United Public Radio Network as News on the Flip Side, hosted by Joe Montaldo, will be coming up next after Michael Angley and the dulcet tones of the Angley Angle to you. And hey, Michael, without you, the listening audience, there is no Voice of the People Radio. What kind of rampant insanity do you have marked up for the audience? Because we haven't left being on the air just yet.
The sun, the moon, the sea, the waves, Trump's porno girl, and everybody, man. Everything you think of.
I hadn't okay. touched that whole porn star reference thing, but that's got to be in there somewhere too, right? I mean, it's just never
volcanoes, and I think we got volcanoes. We got everything going on.
And we have the Invest 90 XL or whatever it was. Now it's a potential tropical storm Alberto haunting the Gulf Coast down here.
Greg, we have breaking news from Fox News, man. Denny's customer arrested after allegedly slapping waitress on butt. I'm just saying, it's great. It's just breaking news. I was like, what the hell kind of breaking news is this? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I know you're wrapping up, so I will shut up.
Should they call that like an ass-slapping break? You know, like we have an ass-slapping break. Hold on, man.
I can see there's a picture of it.
That's crazy.
His hand hasn't made contact yet. I guess I couldn't put that on news, but well, and the bench part is she looks like she knows it's coming because she's like stepping, trying to get step out the way.
I think we could safely say that it wasn't Harvey Weinstein.
Is he out? Yeah, he's out, isn't he?
Yeah, he's out of $1 million bail. He's got an ankle bracelet on. You wear the ankle bracelet. That's the important part.
Just cut that bitch, hop in a private plane and go, man. What are they going to do? Transfer his money to Venezuela or something.
In the immortal words of Bill Cosby during his tirade, at the end of that, I don't think it's come up for sentencing yet, but as he had told the prosecutor, does it really matter because he has a private plane? I don't know, but without you, the listening audience, there is no Voice to People Radio. You will not have me here in a minute or so. You're going to have Michael Angley live, and I don't know what to say about that, Joe. I mean, that's just that as important as, you know, the Korea summit, you know, or this guy that stopped a school shooting in Indiana, or, you know, I mean, somebody, you know, and yeah, I can understand and I sympathize with the lady getting accosted, which I think is a correct term for that, accosted by a rude customer at Denny's. But I don't know if it warrants being on Fox.
What happens if he says that he goes to Denny's so he can do that? Because Denny's allowed. Oh, wait, there's no worse than that one about the CNN and USA Today and a couple of other ones carried a big story about the president was doing the speech at, what was it, at the Navy graduate, at the, you know, the Navy school. And two of them wrote an op-ed piece about him being disabled. Other, 600 candidates didn't say a word, but that's all we're going to hear about is him, too. It was a USA Today article. I was like, really? I was like, what can you do? Anyway, I know I got to let y'all get because Mike's taking over. But
yeah, Michael,
I know I missed those pudding pops, man. It all went wrong when they got rid of pudding pops. Maybe I pushed them over the edge.
Oh, man. Oh. They got rid of pudding pops because you know who's going to prison, the pudding man.
they pushed me over the edge, man. I went crazy.
Have a great show, Michael. I've got to go. I just had my wife walk into the studio bleeding. So you guys have a wonderful afternoon, everybody. Don't miss Michael coming up next.
Right now, save 50 to 70% off absolutely everything at Gap Factory. Even better, get 40% off clearance styles, plus t-shirts from $4.99 and shorts from $9.99. And just in time for summer, save 50 to 70% off the entire store at Banana Republic Factory. Plus, 50% off clearance and doorbuster dresses and polos starting at $19.99. Only at Banana Republic Factory stores. Search our store locator for your nearest Gap Factory and Banana Republic Factory store, or shop us online.
When it comes to your education, there's no need to settle. Get the interactive and purposeful education that you and employers demand from Colorado State University Global Campus. You'll get personalized, career-driven learning created and taught by today's industry leaders. CSU Global was built to help students succeed with affordability, flexibility, and individualized support. It's time to expect better. Find your path to the career you want at csuglobal.edu, where online education isn't another thing we do, it's all we do.